Mr. Gormley, Reel 40. So you've completed your course and you moved back to your Royal Horse Artillery unit. The 6th, I think you said. Yeah. And what happened to you then?
Well, from there, orders came that we move over to a little place called Wickham Market in Suffolk. And so we stopped in battle and we went over to Suffolk. But before going, I would just like to mention that a little incident that happened. It was Tommy Farr had a bar just outside Brighton, and he had this bar. And I used to go and have a talk with him, mate. And of course, we were on milk because we could talk about boxing and that. And I was in this night with him, and we see these three big matlos coming, you know. One was a big, hefty fella, mate. He said, I'm going to have trouble here with that. And he's Welsh accent, mate, you know. I said, trouble with you? I said, no, but I'm going to tackle you. He said, they will. He said, they'll go out. He's coming here just to make trouble. So go out and say he's had a fight with Tommy Farr. And sure enough, about 10 minutes later, his bloke come over and said, came out about the only big Welsh box. And Tommy just up and bloody hit him. He said, take that bugger out and stop. It's funny the things that come into your mind, you know, just like one connects with another, you know. So anyway, we went over to Suffolk and in this little place called Wickham Market, which was a lovely little town in Suffolk. We were also in a big hall there, actually, but the hall was mainly the office. All the office was in the big hall. And the men in that, they had all these billets. They were like mission huts and that, you know, built these billets for us. And we were down there, and that was a good little billet. That there was about 6 or 7 pumps in it. And I had this lad in my section, with Bummery Carstairs. He's an ex-docker from Dublin. A wonderful pianist. So I had a fixed that we'll go in one bar and we'll play there. And if we didn't get our free beer, I'll say, right, come on, Paddy. Come on, Paddy. Down to the next pub, bring it in, slot here. We can't get free beer, you'll not get it anywhere. Down to the next pub, we start playing.
What were you in charge of a gun at this process in the time? You had your gun.
Yeah.
And was this again a 25-pounder?
Yeah. And, no, it was a 25-pounder SP.
Well, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. And so I used to walk from pub to pub to somebody would pay for me.
And what were you doing there, other than
we're just in training with the Panda Div, actually. We were actually there with this Panda Div.
And what form did the training take?
Oh, we're out practically every day, like doing manoeuvres, the 3-day manoeuvres and things like that. 4-day manoeuvres, whatever they said. And they used to ask for people to go out and help them with the chimneys and with the push woods and things like that, you know. They were always short of labour on the land at that time, you know.
That was your spare time, presumably.
That was spare time, you know. But if you had volunteers, they would pay you. They would get well paid for what they did, and they would actually go out and do all the different black cameras or whatever, you know.
And by now, the invasion had gone on, obviously, in D-Day.
Oh, no.
But D-Day was June 1944, and we've been talking about July, haven't we? So probably we've been talking really about mentioning 1944, and we should be talking about 1943, and now we're through into the approach to D-Day in 1944, which is early June.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're now involved in preparations for D-Day.
This has happened, because what had happened was my brother would come home and be transferred into six horses, including me. He'd been posted out, and he went to the 4th Regiment Royal Horse Artillery, and I went straight to him, and I volunteered to go over with him, you know. And they posted me to the 5th Royal Horse Artillery, and I joined the 5th Royal Horse Artillery at Felixstowe. And from there, of course, that was the big jump that I was given there after coming through this course. The big jump I was given was to make sure that everyone was waterproof, ready for the...
And this is where you're waterproofing for the invasion, yeah, really,
ready, ready for the D-Day landings and that, like, you know.
Were you undertaking manoeuvres where you were going on board ships and coming off and practising this, getting onto ship and getting off ship on invasion? You wouldn't do anything like that?
No, I think it was a big shortage of landing craft at the time. You just if it came, you just took it and went on, like, you know.
So the Royal Horse Artillery were basically mechanised, weren't they? Mobilised.
Basically.
Not mobilised, mobile.
Basically mobile, yes. You still had your gun tools and guns, 25 pound of guns.
But you were on wheels.
You also were always on wheels, and then you had your track vehicles, which were the SPs, the priests and that, you know, and they were...
What was the difference between serving in the Royal Artillery and serving in the Royal Horse Artillery? A bit of an upmarket regiment.
Well, the Royal Horse Artillery was different. The big difference was one was the field artillery, and the other was the horse artillery. And the thing there was, the actual difference in the first instance was that the horse artillery always had, they were used as like a light cavalry, if you understand what I mean. Like a light cavalry, and their playbook was first in, last out, you know. Part of the army, right, the first in, last out. You know, that was their motto, and they were used as a galloping cannon, and they used a little 13-pounder gun actually in the original day, where you moved up to the field and they had the 18-pounders and 4 or 5 howitzers, and then you had the 25-pounders. But when they all became mechanised. We still had the 25 pounders on the SPs, but we also had the 25 pounders gun tools. Like, you know,
that both in the regiment.
Both it was the same gun, only one was a wheeled gun and the other was a trap gun. Like, you know. So, I've thrown myself in the drift now.
Well, we were training now basically for the D-Day event,
yeah.
And you're in Suffolk.
We're in Suffolk previously, that, like, and then just we've been volunteering.
Yeah.
Like,
and you moved down to Felixstowe, yeah.
I moved down from Wickham Garden and then down to the...
As D-Day approached...
this is it. You see, as D-Day approached, what they do first, you've just brought it back in my mind. They've taken us down to... right on the side of the river, on the Thames. And we were, they put us in charge of this camp. We had the Canadians in there. And we were in charge of the camp. And that was when they posted me going out. And he went to the 4th. And when I volunteered, I said, well, if he's going on board, you know, if all that hadn't been posted out, I don't suppose I would have gone either, you know, I would have just let it go. Because I still had time to serve, you see. So I was a volunteer.
So you went to the 5th at this point?
That was when I went to the 5th, Shotley. That was the name of the place. Place called Shotley. No, Shotley, no, you're getting on again.
Not to worry, it'll come. It'll come.
Anyway, the name will come. It was where we went. We were just camped alongside alongside the river. And it was just two people that had been posted out there. I volunteered to go with them.
And were you part of the same brigade?
Well, part of the same division.
And same division.
So I never saw.
So what were you doing as D-Day came?
Well, we were just more or less, because this was just about the weeks before D-Day, when I got posted there. I was in battery headquarters, actually, when I went there.
And what were you doing in battery headquarters? What was your job?
I was just a sergeant, but I wasn't in charge of a gun. I was in charge of battery headquarters. Sergeant in charge of the headquarters before I became Sergeant Major. Like, and So, as I say, we went on there and we got loaded up.
Were you sealed in so that you couldn't get in or out in the days prior, immediately prior to D-Day?
Oh, yes, the whole camp was sealed. Every camp was sealed. No way the guards all around the camp. No way to get in or out.
And when this happened, were they talking to you and lecturing you on what you were doing, where you were going and so forth?
Yes, it was you got sick of them, they'll tell you exactly what they expected to happen. And of course, a lot of them, I don't think they were even talking from experience, to be honest with you. I don't think any of them, a lot of them hadn't their experience to tell anything like it.
This would be a unit probably that had been in England for most of the war, if not all the war. Yeah.
Well, the sixth regiment that I joined were hard. Never fired a shot in anger. Never did.
And these been training for invasion, basically.
They've been training all these months. You know, they've never been any training at all. Never had any shot in anger at all.
Did you find it easy to settle into a routine like that?
Oh,
I mean, you'd been in action in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it was just another regiment. You know, I'd already been with the 6th Volunteer for a start, and I'd already been in complex actions all over the place.
So they must have recognised your experience in action.
Yes. I mean, I can remember once we were in there at the market, and we went out on a big firing camp there. And had a few rounds of ammunition left, and this up was a crew. We had have a shot at that tree and put it to a pine tree about 800 yards away. It's really a pine tree, you know. And everybody had a shot and missed it. And I knew what was wrong, like, you know. I said, could I have that last shot, sir? Yes, go on, have it. So I had the last shot. And I hit the back. They didn't know how, and I didn't tell them. But what the thing was, like, the sights were set to converge at 1,000 yards. And everybody had been aiming straight for the truck, but it was only a tree trunk that one. So all I did, when I got on the sight, I just moved the sight over a fraction. Instead of aiming at the trunk, I aimed at the side of the trunk. I hit the thing straight in the middle. How the hell did you do that?
Did you have visitors into your sealed camp? You know, I'm thinking in terms of Eisenhower, Montgomery, and so forth. Were they appearing?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I never actually saw him. Not in our camp. No. I mean, they did come up just before the day. Yeah, like they came on and did a bit of talk to most people. Like, you know.
How did you feel about here? You are. You come back to England after being through some pretty horrendous experiences and then having to go back into action again in another very dangerous situation.
I don't know. I must have been very mad when I came back. I had no need to do it. Like, as I say, because I was entirely 12 months in England, you know. It was just really because of my brother. I'd already thought about one kind of danger thing, and but there again, it made no upset actually, because he sent us this. We were sent to two different regiments.
What are your memories leading up to the actual D-Day itself?
Memories. Well, it was just work. Just hard work, hard doing. Sad as fuck. Plenty of beer and plenty of whiskey and that is. You couldn't get out
of the council. Was the unit G'd up? Was it looking forward to going into action for the first time?
I felt in those days, like, I just accepted whatever came, you know. To me, it was just another job, like, another job which I had to do.
Yeah. I think you said you went over on D plus one the day after D, didn't you?
Yeah. Because we'd gone over these landing craft tanks, they go right above the beach, you know. There were others that were loaded into big tank landing craft, which had to be winched over and dropped over the side, like, you know. But we went under the landing in about 4 foot of water.
Where did you leave from?
From outside Southampton.
It must have been quite a sight. And
Yes, you could dip it all over the bloody place, you know. You could, wherever you looked, you could see now with boats and ships, you know. you just kept your fingers crossed and said, you know. It's too late to do anything about it then, you know.
And when you got to the beach on the other side, do you recall the view of that beach?
Yeah, quite a sandy beach with a lot of underwater obstacles there, like barbed wire and that, which was one of the top. That didn't make any odds to us because we could go right up onto the beach, you know, and then it didn't matter whether they got them off or not. Like, as long as we got off, that was all that mattered to us.
Do you know where you landed? The three British landings were Gold, Juno, and Sword.
We landed on Gold Beach.
You were on Gold Beach, were you?
Yeah.
Or are you with 50? You say,
yeah,
or
yeah,
is you behind?
We were the first armoured vehicles to land on the beach with the SPs to give them support. You know, there were other batteries, we were all behind us. We were the first ones to land. And when we got on, I remember we were looking for a way up, and there was a big sandy dune coming down from the top, you know, and it had all been wired up and everything, the German defences. The sappers and miners went in, and they got these pretty big Bangalore torpedoes. They hung them on the bloody wires, and they blasted away from one end to the other. And went up
there must have been a lot of congestion on the beaches. Stuff landing.
You can't describe it. This was the most organised chaos, and it was organised chaos, and it was. Chaos, absolute chaos, and it was only probably by look that somebody found this pretty, like a little wadi that went up. But as I say, it was all wired off, and they called the sappers and them up, and they went in, and they put these bloody big Bangalore torpedoes in among the bloody wire, and it blew the whole bloody lot sky high, and that left us with the world state up to the top.
Were the
was already on, they had gone ahead of us. Like.
Were there bodies lying around? Did you see bodies?
Bodies all over the bloody place on that day. It couldn't be any other. Bodies, you drove over them, actually. Drove over them. You didn't even see them. You didn't even know they were there.
And you were with headquarters, I think you were saying, at this point. And what happened to you next? You say you drove forward, presumably, and where did you go?
Well, we're going to want to the top, and then when we're going to want to the top, like we'll just then lead it out, like, you know, that's, see, and then we were just there in support of the infantry who were going ahead, like, you know, they were really sticky, like, they would have been badly done. Mind, there was the ships in that were all firing overhead as well, you know, they had all their own targets to fire at, you know, and they did that.
So there were quite furious bombardments going on at the same time. Do you recall where you were called into action for the first time?
Well, it was just off the beach, isn't it? It wouldn't fly off. It was only about half a mile. The infantry had gone in ahead, like, you know, and we got in. It's funny. You had that, there was that many little bloody memories floating about in your mind. It's difficult to pull them together, like, you know.
What's your first clear memory then of the Normandy campaign, which is what we're talking about, really?
Well, my first clear memory was the bloody muck. The carts of bloody muck as we were driving down these little valleys and that, like, you know, and once you got off the beaches, there were very, very deep sunken roads, you know, and you had to go by on the top, really. You couldn't go on the road, right, because they were all bloody mined in that. So you're plodging through bloody mines, they were wheat fields and things like that, and everything was bloody churning up underneath you, you know, wasn't it? Very difficult. There was lots of really fighting going on this way, that way, and the other way. You didn't know. You didn't know who was fighting it, so. But,
And your actual role in the headquarters, what was that? What were you actually doing in the artillery headquarters?
We had our own battery headquarters. This is, everything stems from there.
Yeah.
You see, I was more or less in charge of battery headquarters for that particular period of time. And of course, as a casualty started mounting, and I was sent out to a gun, and I went up the gun, like, you know. And because. As I said, we were falling like very flies, to be honest.
As the Germans were fighting, were you in the what they call the Bocage country?
That's what I'm talking about. When you go down among all these many little, there were sunken roads. Like, the roads were sunk down below the level of the fields around it, like, you know. And you go down into that Bocage country, it was very terrible there. Like, for the infantry, man, I thought it must have been horrendous. Because, I mean, they must have been up here in Britain class and looked at them and plugged into the oil and said, all these fields and that. At least we had the tanks, we were just driving through the tanks. We were fairly well off, you know.
But the Germans fought pretty well, didn't they, the whole
time? At the beginning, yeah. There was no way we were going to get past them. It was very difficult. Because from what you've read about it and seen about it, like, you can understand why. Because we've drawn all the bloody armour. They've drawn all the armour down on the whole front, which was where they thought the big breakthrough was going to come, when the big breakthrough came through on the American front, which had been left more or less, well, not undefended, like, but. Of course, it was a hell of a job getting ashore. They had a hell of a job.
So your role with the 25-pounder would be infantry support, was it?
Oh, yes, at that time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Before the whole of the div came over, and then we became part of the armoured division.
Could you fire in an anti-tank role as well? Could you go for tanks as well?
Oh, yeah. You had armoured piercing and shells in there. Oh, yes.
Do you recall any particular action in Normandy that you got involved in?
Oh, there was lots of action there. I wish I had time to refresh my memory a little bit. I didn't think we'd get as far as it, solely because I've lost track of that very doings there. going down to the McCars company, there was a lot of the tanks got stopped. I don't remember that. About 12 of them. They got down in this very sunken road. That's why we wouldn't go down. They got trapped in this sunken road. And they blocked the tank off at that end, and they blocked the tank off at this end. And we can remember watching this boat going, driving down and chucking pretty grenades into the tanks.
The German?
Yeah.
These were German tanks so in the road?
German tanks mixed up with them, we were firing at them.
Sorry, yeah. I just want to get the picture. These were these British tanks that were trapped?
British tanks that had gone down into the ship.
And they were trapped?
Yeah. They got bloody trapped. Yeah. They drank the bottom of both ends. And then they just going down the swamp with the grenades all around them. There was no way they could do anything. They couldn't even swivel the turret and out like that. I remember that. I know, because we were firing at them, trying to disturb them, but it didn't have much bloody luck. It's just one of those things that happened.
And you don't remember where this particular spot was in Normandy?
I can sure find out if I go a certain book out. It wasn't far up there. It was way past the what they call the Pegasus Bridge. It was way past there.
So had you moved over then onto that section?
We were heading down, we're heading way down towards the Falaise, you know, the what they call it?
Falaise Gap, the, you know, that area.
No, before that. Tracy
Bacage? It was Tracy Bacage.
I think it was round about the Tracy Bacage, yeah. I think that was the name. Just caught me in mind.
So you must have moved possibly from one division to, not necessarily staying with the 50th, or moving from one division to another.
Once the armour, the full armour came on, we were operating as an armoured div then. We were operating as an armoured div. We were always giving support to the infantry as it went down. But I was trying to think now. Tracy Bacage. We're flattened up the defense, if I remember right. They're both flattened. They were on one side and we were on the other, and we're both firing in the end. It was just a heap of bloody rubble at the end by the time we finished. It was just a heap of rubble.
But movement was very, as you said, was extremely difficult.
Movement was very difficult in all aspects for everyone, for the infantry and the gunners and that. It was very, very difficult to move.
Booby traps you've mentioned. What about snipers? Were they taking pot shots at you?
Yeah, but they were sniped mainly at the tank crews. If they saw a bloke with his head circled, they would have it off, like, you know, kind of style. But there was snipers right there, but not to the extent that we had with the Japanese, like. But there was snipers there. But as I say, that.
We mentioned the word booby trap, but were you coming across heavy booby trapped areas?
Well, there were areas that we went through, before you moved, actually, you used to check everybody's heads back. Because we were often called on to do patrol work for the infantry to give them a rest.
And you're still being sent out on that kind of activity?
Because, as I say, the infantry had a terrible bloody job. And they used to designate certain areas, and you were left to patrol that. Just in case of any enfilading by German troops, and you had to deal with all that. It's amazing how it comes to your rank,